Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. I am very pleased to have as my guest today the writer Jessica Anya Blau. How are you, Jessica?
I'm great. Great to talk to you, Rich.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. Jessica Anya Blau's newest novel, The Wonderbread Summer, has appeared on CNN, NPR, and Oprah's Book Club top reading lists. Her novel, Drinking Closer to Home, has also appeared on many best of lists. Her first novel, The Summer of Naked Swim Parties, was a national bestseller and picked as a best summer book by The Today Show, The New York Post, and New York Magazine. Her short stories have appeared in numerous magazines and have won numerous awards. Jessica's nonfiction essays have appeared in Newsweek, The Huffington Post, and on the AOL homepage. Several of her short stories and essays have been anthologized in books such as The Prose Reader, Essays for Thinking, Reading, and Writing, and Dirty Words, A Literary Encyclopedia of Sex, and The Nervous Breakdown's Beautiful Anthology. Jessica, you know, if I'm not mistaken, you just got out of a yoga class not long ago. Is that right?
I did, and you were so great to wait for me to have my yoga class before
we
spoke.
Well, you know, I'm a great appreciator of yoga, so that was totally fine. What kind of yoga?
You know, I guess I'm not one of those yoga people who knows the difference. I go to my gym where they have these different classes, so I know there are different kinds of yoga. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what's what. But this one was slow but nice and a little meditative. So I don't
nice.
What kind is that? Do you know?
It would be the non-sweaty sort of, probably not much of a vinyasa flow class. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it wasn't the one where like sweat is flying at you when people move, which
sweat getting on your mat.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes there's that sweat that hits you, like when you stand up, and which can be a little disturbing. But
right.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I go to yoga like 3, 4, or 5 times a week, depending on my week. But and so I go to different classes and different teachers every time. But I'm not sure how good a yogi I am because I can't stand looking at really gross, like scaly, dry feet with like chipped toenails and toe fungus. So I always have to position myself, like I pick out the person with good feet and go
right.
behind them, or I position myself so that I don't have to look at feet.
Right.
So
you
I don't know.
Just be in
I'm
front
not
of the
sure
class
if I'm
and just
a very
stare
good...
at a wall or something.
Right. I mean, I try and get that corner, but if you don't show up in time, then
you know?
you can land behind some really nasty feet. And so that's what I'm working on in improving myself is foot acceptance.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm trying to have foot acceptance.
Well, speaking of...
I do accept humans, but
yes,
not feet.
But not their feet, yes.
Yes.
Speaking of foot acceptance in yoga, this is recalling a story. I was once in a yoga class with Diane Keaton, and...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and well, here in L.A., you know, it's kind of sort of almost one of those everyday things sometimes. But the teacher had positioned us in a way where we were all sort of lying down in a row and had our feet, our legs sort of on this part of a stage or whatever. So our thighs were lifted and our calves and feet were on this stage and Diane Keaton was next to me and there was a point where our feet touched one another and she sort of looked at me and I looked at her. And I so wanted to say to her, you know, like, I'll never wash that foot again.
I
just let that one slide.
I love her, but Rich, do you remember what, did she have nice feet? Like, do you remember what they look like?
I think I was just so enthralled with the fact that my foot even touched hers that, and then, you know, when I looked and we were sort of looking in each other's eyes that I didn't even really recall what her foot looked like. I do remember in one class with the same teacher, he had us get in a circle before class, and I was standing next to Jennifer Beals, and we held hands.
Wow.
And, you know, she had a nice hand, you know. I don't know what her feet were
yeah.
like.
Yeah. Well, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
They're both beautiful. I love wow, that's two great women to have in yoga. Well, I would go behind either of their feet,
yes,
no matter what they
no
look
matter
like.
What
because
their
I,
feet look
I,
like, yes.
Right, because I can get a little starstruck. I kind of like, I like looking at celebrities. I try and act cool when I see them, but, you know, I just can't help but look at them also. I'm not so cool that I look away.
Yes,
but,
yes. I hear you. And we're gonna talk about L.A. in a little while because it definitely figures in prominently to the Wonder Bread Summer, which actually, why don't we go ahead and just start talking about that wonderful book, how you became inspired to write it?
Yeah, sure. So the Wonder Bread Summer takes place in Berkeley in 1983 when 20-year-old Allie accidentally steals a bread bag full of cocaine and goes on the lam, and she ends up in Los Angeles, and there's, you know, a lot of stuff happens. And the book, I was inspired by the book because when I lived in Berkeley, when I was a student there, a whole bunch of different things happened one summer. And among them was that a guy ran into my apartment with a bread bag full of cocaine. And it was such a shocking sight. Like, he ran in my apartment and then he let it unwind and showed me what was in it. And it was a Weber's bread bag. It wasn't a Wonder Bread. But it was a Weber's bread bag full of cocaine. It was just so stunning to see something like that. So that sort of stuck in my mind. And the other thing is I got a job at this sweet little clothing store. I was desperate for money that summer because I didn't go home, and so I had to support myself. And I got this job at this great little clothing store, and my friend and I got the job when we were sitting at a bar, so I'm not quite sure if you really ever want to get a job when you're talking to a guy at a bar, but it was this really good-looking guy, this kind of suave, great-looking guy who was really well-dressed, and he offered us a job in his clothing store. And we took the job, and, you know, and we were both working there, you know, sometimes together, sometimes apart. And nobody ever came into the store, or like every now and then. And the job was in like one of the worst parts of Oakland where nobody was. It was like boarded up old houses across the street in one direction, a liquor store across the street in the other direction, and then a rib joint down the street that had like some of the best ribs in Oakland and Berkeley that people went to. So that would kind of, people were there, but they never even crossed the street and came to the store. And so it took me a while because I was sort of a dumbass and kind of and pretty naive at 20, but it took me a while to realize the guy was stealing cocaine, and the store was essentially a front for a major cocaine dealership. Do you call it a dealership, like cars?
Cocaine dealership, nice.
But it was a dealership. Yes, it was a franchise. So I was thinking about that, and then when I was working there, can we say anything on this? Internet
radio,
right?
Oh, yeah, say anything you want, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when I was working there, whenever I worked alone, he started pulling his dick out while I was working. And so I was 20 and sort of a people pleaser. You know, I mean, I was the student who would sit in the front of the class and make eye contact with the teacher and would never dare look away or, you know, I mean, I was always the person who would try and make everybody happy and, you know, didn't really think of myself as sort of even having needs or desires or rights of my own. I was just sort of this receptive person. And so he would pull his dick out. I didn't have the wherewithal, the strength, the intelligence, the courage, or anything to say, like, put your dick away.
I guess that would really, someone pulling their dick out in front of you, I guess that would really test your people-pleasing skills at that point.
Oh, yeah. And just, like, how do you negotiate that? And then just, like, this overriding desire since I was a little kid to like make everybody around me happy and make sure that everybody else was happy and not to cause trouble, like not to cause ripples. Like, you know, I grew up in a family where my parents were just, you know, I mean, they're great, intelligent people, but they were just like out of control and wild and fighting and, you know, having affairs and whatever they were doing. And then my sister had all these problems and she was always at the shrink and, you know, and all these things are happening to her, and then my brother was the little genius, and then I was just the invisible one who, like, just didn't cause any problems, like, no trouble. So here's this guy pulling his dick out, and I would just be like, oh, you know, I'd laugh, oh, you know, what if a customer comes in? I'd be like, no customer's coming in here. You know, and he had this enormous dick also, so it was, at 20, it was kind of scary. you know, it was it seemed more like a weapon than a dick. So so anyway, I was thinking about all these things, and I was thinking about the summer. Oh, and the other thing that happened is I was set up on a blind date. My best friend started dating this 40-year-old lawyer, which just seemed insane.
Right.
And he wanted to set me up with somebody, and I was really poor and really hungry, and they were meeting for Mexican food, and I was like, ah, okay. So I went just because I was so hungry, and they set me up with like this 40-year-old paraplegic in a wheelchair. So it was like the strangest blind date ever because I was 20. I was like interested in guys who were like 20 and 22 and, you know, throwing a football on the lawn or whatever.
Right.
And so what I wasn't, you know, I mean, maybe I would date a guy in a wheelchair now because whatever. But back then it's like, I wouldn't roll somebody around and date them. So anyway, that was another thing that happened. And then the other thing, I don't know how many things I've listed here, was when I was at Berkeley, I used to study at this cafe called Cafe Rama, which I think is still there. And all these people, and I'd meet my professors there for meetings and office hours and the TAs, and it was just this center of studying and drinking coffee. And there was this quadriplegic who couldn't speak, and he had no language, and he had a head pointer, like a little head pointer on right. with a little felt tip on the end, and he had like a Ouija board across the arms of his wheelchair, and he communicated with that. And his wife used to push him over to me and give me his coffee, and I would sit there, and of course, you know, the people please it. I'm like, sure, and I would sit there, and I would study and give him his coffee, and she would go off and do whatever she did. And I would feed him his coffee because he had no use of anything. And then he would tap out words, and we'd talk. And then after, you know, maybe a couple of years, I'd known him for a couple of years, she asked me one day if I wanted to be in one of his movies and said he was a film director. And I said, oh, I had no idea he's a film director. She said, yeah, he directs movies. And, you know, we started talking about this. And I said, well, what would I do in the movie? You know, he wanted me to be in the movie. I said, well, what would I do in the movie? She said, well, you know, there are erotic films, and you would have sex in the movie.
Nice.
And I said, yeah, I said, well, who would I have sex with? And she said, with, and I won't say his real name. And she said, with me. And I thought, whoa, like, you want me to have sex with you and your husband in a movie, and he's a film director? And the whole thing kind of blew my mind. And so anyway, I worked that into the book. So all of those things really happened in real life, and I pulled them all together
mm-hmm.
and put them in this book. And then I just have to say as an aside that my husband never believed me about the quadriplegic with the head pointer on the Ouija board who directed...
Right, porn films, yeah.
Films. And recently being like a year and a half ago, I was at a party, and there was this author, and he's like this big New York Times bestselling author, and he went to Berkeley, and he was there around the same time I was, and I asked him if he knew the guy in the wheelchair, you know, with the head pointer. He said, oh, yeah, I've seen his films. And I said, you mean his, like, porn films? He's like, well, you know, they're erotic films of him having sex, you know, porn or whatever. And I had to run across the room and grab my husband and introduce him and just see this guy can verify for me that this guy made these films. And then they were online. He emailed me a link to them, so I've actually seen them since
wow.
then. But, yeah, so anyway.
I'm probably thinking
there,
but for
together,
the grace of God, go I.
Yeah, totally. Like, wasn't trying to please him and his wife. Thank God I didn't do that.
Right.
So I pulled all those things together and threw them into a novel with a 20-year-old girl who is somewhat like me, and just made it a little more dangerous than I just, you know, added theft.
Right.
Theft in a chase.
Yes.
You know. And anyway, that's how the book came to be.
Nice. You know, as you were talking about all these great experiences that happened to you, which sort of informed a lot of the experiences in the novel, how did you go about taking all those fantastic experiences and corralling them? I mean, were there ever points where you had to tweak things a certain way and fictionalize real experiences to some degree so that they would fit into the context? Or, you know, because with my own writing sometimes, you know, there are these experiences I want to write about, and, you know, I want to jam them all into one piece of writing. And then at a certain point, it's like, you know what, I've got to let certain things go, or I've got to, you know, maybe tweak this one just a little bit. Or how was that for you, either with this novel or with some of your other writing?
I mean, I don't feel any desire to tell the truth or to tell things how they are. I mean, that's why I always write fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah.
So I don't worry about, like, I always feel like my allegiance is to the story, to trying to write the best story I can write. And my allegiance is not to the facts or the truth. So it's more like these facts and this truth just inspired a story that I've completely made up. So, you know, if you went through the novel and you can find things and people say, well, is that true? I say, yeah, it's true, but it's true under different circumstances at a different time with different, you know.
Yeah.
So it's always just inspired, and there's no, so I never stick to the exact truth. And, you know, and it's always trying to work on the story and not trying to tell my story or my real story or my life story, which I don't feel a compulsion to tell. I just simply, you know, use it. I take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like I need anyone to know. But people always do want, you know, well, how did you get this idea? And it just happens to come from life. So really, it's all, I'm constantly throwing away facts and time and reality and just sticking to the story. And this story, Wonder Bread Summer, I mean, I originally wrote a chapter, which wasn't a chapter, which is a short story about working at the clothing store and the guy pulling out his dick, and
right.
he was trying to masturbate, and he wanted to masturbate. And so I wrote a short, and the other girl I worked there with went in the fitting room with him and allowed him to masturbate while looking at it.
Which is actually a scene in the book that sort of opens up the novel, if I remember correctly.
Right. It starts with her in the fitting room when he's masturbating. And he asked me to do that, and I didn't. I was like, no. But the other girl I worked with did, and she told me she did. And I was so shocked. And so the short story I wrote originally is I was remembering that, and I thought, wow, what would it feel like to do that? What does it take in your mind and in your heart? And because I was such a dumbass and did so many stupid, regrettable things, but somehow I didn't do that. And then I thought, well, where would you have to be in your head to go into a fitting room with some guy that you're not attracted to and don't love and don't have a relationship with and just sit there naked and let him jerk off? Like, where's your head?
Right.
So originally what I wrote was a short story putting myself in that frame of mind and trying to think where I would have to be in my head to do that. And then that short story was published in New York Tyrant. And then I started thinking about it in the form of a novel. So the whole novel was originally written in first-person present tense, and then it was written in first-person past tense, and then it was written in third-person past. You know, so I rewrite a lot and a lot and a lot. And as I'm rewriting, everything gets shifted and changed. And so I might start out with a whole bunch of facts that are written in the way they happen, but by the time I've revised it, nothing is where it started.
Right.
And I don't care, I guess, because I'm not writing nonfiction, so I don't have to hold to the truth. I mean, emotionally, it's true. Like,
yeah.
I do feel like it needs to be emotionally sort of honest and real. Like, you can't fake it in writing. And, you know, it's horrible when people are faking it in writing. You can read it. I mean, you can see it in the words when they're trying to pull something off and they're trying to either be smarter than they are, wittier or whatever, more interesting. And so emotionally, it's true. I'm trying not to fake anything, but the facts are totally made up and it's fiction.
So when it first, you know, started out its journey to where it is now as a novel, did you sort of bring all those changes about yourself? Did you have an editor kind of guide you in any way, saying, oh, why don't you try this or this?
Well, the editor I've had the same editor for all three books at HarperCollins, and it's Kate Mitchell, and she's brilliant. I love her. And she did, there are things like, why don't you try it in third person? I mean, there are little suggestions. She's she does macro suggestions. She never does micro. Like, the, I mean, if we were just a few months before you have to close it down, you can't make any more changes. And she said, you know, I think the whole ending doesn't work and you just have to redo it. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, she's right. I mean, she always has that thing that I think all editors say, in the end, it's your book and your name is on it. You can do whatever you like. But everything she says is so smart that I almost always take her advice. I mean, you know, not 100% of the time, but usually I take her advice. And I thought, ah, she's right. The ending is really sort of cheesy Hollywood and people get shot and the bad guys get killed. And so she's right. And so I reworked the whole end and reworked and reworked and reworked it. And we got to a place where, you know, she loved it. And I can't look at it and love it or hate it or anything, but I could sense that it worked.
Right.
And I knew what was wrong with the first ending after I changed it. And I could tell that the problem with the first ending is that it wasn't authentic. And it didn't feel totally emotionally true. It felt like somebody coming in and just trying to make a big bang in the end. And so it was reworked, and I think it was definitely much better. I mean, the interesting thing is the book was optioned, and I was, you know, they were nice enough to show me the script they wrote for the movie. And the script for the movie, the first two-thirds are pretty much true to the book, and the last third is like they totally threw away my ending, and they put this scene where everybody shoot each other and everybody gets killed and all the bad guys get killed. So it's sort of back to what I originally wrote, which was, I guess, much more cinematic than how the book ended up. So the ending is, I mean, they didn't have them all killed the same way, you know, the person who wrote the script. But I do think that was funny. It was like, oh, wow, okay, so we're back to that. Although I can't remember if I've told Kate, my editor, that yet or not. I have to let her know that they've gone back to killing everybody in the end.
Well, that's pretty exciting. I mean, here's a question for you. I mean, when a situation like that and a film company comes to you and says, okay, you know, two-thirds of your book we're keeping the same way and then we're changing the ending of it, how much control do you have as the writer to be able to say, yeah, I agree with that, or no, I want you to, you know, stay closer to the book?
No control. I mean, the thing is, it's funny, there were multiple offers on it and there were five people trying to buy it. And so there were like weeks of phone calls with all these people, which I didn't understand what was happening at first when my agent at CAA is setting me up with all these phone calls. And the people are discussing the book and what they think, how are they going to develop the script and what they want to happen. And this, you know, and everybody's making these different promises. And essentially, you know, the agent's saying, this is the only time you have a say. Like, once you sell it, you've given up everything. Like, once you sign that contract and you take their check, you've given up everything. So it was sort of like in deciding which offer to take, and in the end there were three offers on the table, it was like that was the only decision I got to make, and that was the only place where I had any control. And so I sold it to the person who I thought would make the best movie and the best script, and I think these people will. And I think I made the right choice, and the woman who wrote the script is totally great. I mean, I love her, and she's called and emailed and talked to me, and she's written a lot of big movies and hit movies, and, you know, she's a kind of a big deal writer, and she was great. And so in the end, once I gave it up, I gave it up, and I'm trusting her. And when she wrote that ending, I thought, she's written hit movies, and she's, you know, this person who knows what she's doing, and I do have faith in her. I mean, it's not the ending I wrote, but it's like, okay, you know movies, and you know Hollywood, and you know what will work on screen, and the difference between sitting alone in a room in your head and reading something and sitting in a room with lots of people watching it on a screen. So in giving up control, there's no urge in me to come over and take over and try and rewrite it. I have faith in her.
Right. As you were writing the book, you know, because you spoke before about the original ending you had being more cinematic, as you were writing the book, Were there moments where you thought, wow, this would make a really good film?
No, mostly because I don't think that way. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I'm always like, I stick my head, I, you know, right on a wooden table, I stick drop my forehead on the table and just pray that it's good enough that somebody will want to publish it.
Right.
So I'm more at
right.
the stage where I'm just like, you know, help me, you know, just pray. Help me write well today. You know,
yeah.
I hope I can write something incredible and I hope it gets published. So to think, oh, this would make a good movie is beyond.
Yeah.
I just am, you know, always hoping it'll get published and
yeah.
then hoping it'll, somebody will buy the book and then hoping people, you know, I mean, you just, it's like there's, you can't control it. Other than what you write that day. So I think I try and narrow my scope of just controlling what I can control.
Yeah.
Which is just trying to write well.
Right. So Larry Doyle, Matthew Clam, and other wonderful writers have said great things about you and the Wonder Bread Summer. Also, you know, one of my absolute fave writers, Nick Hornby, devoted an entire column in The Believer to sing your praises. You know, I mean, we're talking friggin' Nick Hornby here. How did you originally get the book to him, and what was your reaction once you'd read his review?
Well, I mean, I have HarperCollins to give me a publicist. The publicist gets these books out there.
Right.
And Nick Hornby, I mean, the column has, I think, four or five books, but he did a big chunk of it was my book. When I read that, I was in a Starbucks, and I got a note from my publicist to HarperCollins. I said, you just got a review that I'm calling a love letter from Nick Hornby. And he attached it, and I tried to open it in Starbucks, and I couldn't open it. And then I forwarded it to a friend, and I got in the car, and I called her, and I said, can you open this? And she opened it and read it to me while I was in the car driving. It was like, I love Nick Hornby. Like, I love his books. I taught one of his books at Hopkins. You know, I must have read it four or five times just
mm-hmm.
teaching it. And I love his work. And actually, love the Believer columns, you know, books I've read. So it was so great. I mean, it's always great to be praised. We all love it, I guess. Like maybe there's praise that you don't want to get. But, you know, we all love it. And it's great to be praised from people you admire. I mean, that's the greatest praise, is to be praised by somebody you admire. So that was great. And Matt Clam, I love his book, too, and I love his writing, and that was just an incredible blurb. And Larry is totally great, and I love his, you know, work. And, you know, so it's all nice. It makes me feel great. And then on the other hand, you know, and then there's people who, whatever, on Amazon who hate it and write these horrible reviews. So on the one hand, it feels really good. And I try not to take any of it in, the good or the bad. Like, the good is great. It makes me unbelievably happy. And I want it to keep coming, and I don't want it to go away.
Mm-hmm.
But I also sort of keep it outside of myself because otherwise I have to internal the bad as well.
Right.
So it's like, if you're going to take in the good, you have to take in the bad, and I don't want to absorb the bad either. So
yeah.
I just sort of keep it, look at it and think, wow, that's great, and then keep it outside of me.
Yeah, well, that fascinates me because I would imagine it might be a little disorienting at times to, you know, all these great things happening, you know, it's Wonder Bread Summer being optioned for a film and you know, Nick Hornby and this and that. And also, you know, your past novels, too, have received great praise. I would imagine that it could be a little disorienting to have all that praise heaped upon you, and then, you know, you kind of have to come back and sit in front of the computer and say, okay, now I've got to get back to work. What are some specific things that you do in your life that kind of help to ground you and help keep you centered and focused on the writing when you've got this sort of whirlwind of love and haters sort of swirling around you?
Right, yeah. Well, I think, you're right, it is a whirlwind. I mean, I think the way my life is set up, you know, I mean, I don't have an office where I write either in cafes with friends who write, or I write at my dining room table. And David, my husband, we're both huge Rich Ferguson fans, and mm-hmm. David is a great fan of yours, and he was actually just working on something the other day and showed someone your music.
I heard him.
He said, you heard this guy, Rich Ferguson? And he was playing music for somebody, some producer he was working with.
Oh, cool.
Just the other day. So, but he has a studio up on the third floor of the house. You know, so he shuts off the world, and he's up there working. And there are people in and out of our house going up to the third floor and working with him. And nobody treats me as anything sacred, so I can't treat myself or my work as it. So there's, you know, I am, you know, I have two kids and I have a dog and I have a house and, you know, and I'm running around, I'm grocery shopping and I'm doing the dishes and cleaning and doing laundry. So there's nothing precious or sacred about me in my life.
Right.
You know, just because I write a book and people praise it. You know, in my real life, I'm schlepping out to the store. Right now, you know, we're just snowed in like mad. It's a snowy, icy shithole out here.
Right.
And
you've got disgusting feet in your face and yoga, you know, it's all these things just hoping to keep it real.
Yeah, I got this dog barfing on the carpet yesterday. Yeah, I mean, it's just not. My daughter had six people over yesterday. They were painting in a room in the house that we call the library. You know, there's a bunch of kids and popcorn and music. And, you know, and I was kind of trying to write yesterday, but it's like nobody in the world gives a shit, you know, what I do or what I get done. There's no, she's writing, you know. So it's very hard for me. I guess what I'm saying is it would almost be impossible for anything to enter my head and for me to feel special or precious for a single second the way my life works. So
right.
It's always, everything is always in perspective around here, you know, as I'm cleaning up dog barf and folding laundry and, you know. So it's, yeah, so there's this great stuff that happens, but it is even outside of my life in a way. It's more like dream stuff in a way.
Right. Why don't you go ahead and read something from the novel?
Okay.
It'd be great to hear. And, you know, set it up however you need to or whatever.
Well, what if I read the opening scene?
Oh, that would be great. Now, I remember now, when I saw you here in Los Angeles, I guess maybe last summer or something, you read something, and I think you... Was this a section of the book that you mentioned something about your mom and felt embarrassed about reading it in front of your mom, or she thought that you should read it live or something like that?
No, it was that the opening scene is really intense. And the opening scene is somewhat true, and you'll know from what I've already told you. But when I was talking to my mother, who, you know, grew marijuana, went to the nude beach, smoked pot endlessly, and was this kind of wild hippie mother, you know, as an old woman, just was like, you cannot read that opening scene in public. You just can't. So she was horrified by it. So then I asked Kate, my editor, I was like, do you think I can read that opening, you know, when I'm on book tour? You know, so before book tour, I said, do you think I can read the opening scene? And Kate said, I really don't think you should read the opening scene. Like, you just can't read the opening scene. So there's all this, like, you know, the shock of the opening scene, which is, you know, like, happened in real life. And so then when I was in L.A. with you at that L.A. reading,
yeah.
And it was me, you, Deborah Reed, and Ben Lurie. So it was the four of us, and you guys are all incredibly cool. And, you know, and I love your music and your poems, and I love their books. And, like, I'm looking out at the audience, and there's all these pretty cool people out there, you know. I mean, Larry Doyle was there. He's a great guy, you know. And there's all these kind of cool people out there, and there were no kids around. And I thought, this is the time to read the opening scene. And that was the only time on the book tour that I read the opening scene.
Wow.
But it was a very, yeah, so it was a very cool, because it was L.A. What is that neighborhood we were in? I don't know L.A. well enough to. Yeah, that was like a kind of cool area,
yeah.
And that bookstore, what was the bookstore, Chevalier?
Chevalier's, uh-huh.
Yeah, and that was a cool bookstore, and those owners were, like, I think those were the owners, the people who were there. They just seemed really I mean, it was like L.A. cool. I thought, there's any time I can read this opening statement, it's here. So yeah, that was the only time we did it. All right.
Nice. Well, go for it now.
Okay, and then how much do you think I should read? Just a couple pages?
As much as you would like. Yeah, just, you know, wherever you feel it's appropriate, as much as you'd like.
Okay. Okay, great. All right, so this is the opening chapter of Wonder Bread Summer, and it's 1983. Allie was in a fitting room with a 33-year-old man named Jonas, pulling pinches of cocaine out of a Wonder Bread bag that was more than three-quarters full. It was the first time she had tried coke. Her heart was rat-a-tat-tatting, and her limbs were trembling like a small poodle. Clearly, this had been a poor decision. Her best friend, Beth, had been doing coke all year, particularly at the end of each semester, as she and Allie studied for exams. Beth was a French major, too. She was fun. She was happy. And she didn't seem to mind that Allie stayed straight while Beth did any kind of drug that was handed to her. It was an ideal college friendship. The two girls balanced each other like a perfectly poised seesaw, and they laughed together at everything, no matter what their mental state. Worse than the jitteriness from the coke was the fact that Jonas, who was perched on a little copper-footed stool exactly like the one on which Allie sat, was now holding out his bare dick, which was black as espresso, blacker than his face, and as thick as a pair of tube socks rolled up. "Ever see one like this?" Jonas asked. He seductively rolled his voice as if Allie should have been happy to view his offering. "No," Allie said. This was true. Jonas's was only the second penis Allie had ever seen in her life. She'd never even seen her father with his shirt off. And although the general form was similar to the one penis she knew, Allie was shocked by it, as shocked as if Jonas had pulled out his small intestine and laid that on his palm. Jonas owned Miss Shirley's dress shop on a shabby corner of Oakland that bordered Berkeley. Allie and Beth had met him 3 months earlier after he approached them in Carlos Murphy's eatery. Sitting up at the bar with her fake ID and her dark red curls blown out into a sheet of silk, Allie had thought that for the first time in her life, she might be bordering on cool. Jonas sat down beside her, dressed like someone from the pages of GQ, with a slick black beeper attached to his belt, and said, "You're Allie, aren't you?" And then he offered her and Beth jobs right then and there without even asking if they were qualified. Of course Allie said yes. She'd been looking for a job for months and hadn't been able to find anything that was less than a 40-minute bus ride from her apartment. At that moment, with a hot, flirty bartender calling her name and a summer job she could show up at the very next day, Allie thought her good luck was ramping up. But now, looking at Jonas's dick waggling out of his fly, half up as if it were being held by an invisible wire, Allie wondered if what little luck she had was starting to run out. "I've got to get out of here." Allie could hear the quaver in her voice. "No, you don't," Jonas said, and he waved his dick from side to side, then pulled his balls out from his underpants, conjoined black kumquats. "Yes, I do." Allie reminded herself to breathe. She wiped her nose with the base of her palm, then stood and pushed the fitting room curtain aside. "What the fuck?" Jonas reached out from the stool and pulled the curtain closed again. "Someone could see us back here." It was a straight shot from the fitting room to the display window and glass door. "So maybe we shouldn't be back here." Allie wished she could worm her fingers up her nose, down her sinuses, through the ventricles of her heart, and rub out all the coke she had done, like erasing chalk from a blackboard. She wished she could swirl her hands in the air and erase Jonas, too. All right, why don't I stop there?
Okay. Nice. So there you go, Poetescape listeners, the rarely read, part of the rarely read introduction to the Wonder Bread Summer by Jessica Anya Blau.
Right. So if you don't like that, don't buy the book. If you like that, get the book.
Yes, please do.
Right.
You know, something that I've seen in a lot of, well, at least a number of the reviews for the novel, the idea of Alice in Wonderland allusions that are found throughout the novel. What's your history with that story? When did you first read it, and how did making the connection with Alice in Wonderland help you when writing your novel?
Well, I didn't even see the connection, and my agent read a draft of the book, and she said, "This is like modern-day Alice in Wonderland." And I thought, oh, yeah, you're right. I mean, there was she carried a pink, actually, at the time, rabbit foot, you know, keychain. There was, like, Coke. She was, like, you know, that messes her up. You know, she feels big. She feels small. There was, she's lost. She's trying to get back. She kind of falls down this rabbit hole, mm-hmm. and there's all this kind of trippy stuff going on. So I didn't see the connection. I thought, oh, that's funny, and I didn't really think anything of it. And then she had lunch with my editor, Kate, and told Kate, and then Kate called me up and said, you know, I love that Alice in Wonderland thing she's seeing. Can you just tighten it a little bit? And I thought, sure. So it was already there. So I made the pink rabbit foot white, and then it was like the white rabbit foot.
Right.
And, you know, the her mother was already like the Queen of Hearts. And, you know, I mean, so it was almost like somehow my subconscious had worked it in there. I actually love Alice in Wonderland. I love that story, and I love the writing, and I love how sort of trippy it is. So it is a story that I love. But when I wrote it, originally I wasn't thinking of it at all. When in a revision, it was in my head, and certain things were just sort of fine-tuned to heighten that feeling a little bit.
Right. So
it really isn't a play-by-play Alice in Wonderland.
No.
It's just a trippy story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just staying with that connection just for a moment, you know, you're a Southern California girl. You grew up in Santa Barbara, so you definitely have experiences and connection to this lay of the land out here. What aspects of California would you say feel like a wonderland to you, and what aspects make you feel like you're falling down like an unending, hellish rabbit hole?
Well, I love California. I mean, don't you love California?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're from the East Coast,
I'm from the
right?
East Coast, yeah, like North Carolina and New Jersey, yeah.
Wow, yeah. So, I mean, I love California, and I haven't lived there in years just because of the way life has gone. And so, I mean, California is a wonderland, and L.A. is so trippy, there's nothing I don't like about California. I mean, there's like intense traffic in LA, but I know that I'm in a minority, or maybe a minority of one, in that I never really mind sitting in traffic. It's like I find it sort of relaxing, and you can watch people in the cars around you, and you can turn up the music, and you can think about things. I mean, like it always seems like an interesting point in life. And you're like, oh, look at that person over there. And, you know, so even the stuff that drives people insane doesn't really bother me that much. I don't like smog, so maybe that.
Right.
But people are so different in California. Like, first of all, I'm in Baltimore now, and there wasn't a Trader Joe's here for years. So I was going to Trader Joe's in California for years before I went here. And then finally a Trader Joe's opened up in Baltimore, and it was just like, one of my best friends here is from Southern California, too. We were just so excited. We couldn't wait for Trader Joe's. And we'd go to Trader Joe's. It's just a totally different experience. And then I'll be in California, you know, visiting friends in L.A. or visiting my family in Santa Barbara, and I'll go to Trader Joe's. And it's like, that's like the rabbit. I'll be in Trader Joe's, and the woman next to me will be 65, wearing like a fishnet shirt with her bra showing through and like incredible beautiful breasts and, you know, and her yoga pants or something. And it's just like, whoa. And it's like, you just don't see that in Baltimore. Like you don't have standing in line at Trader Joe's. It's not the same experience as standing in line at Trader Joe's in Santa Barbara or Trader Joe's near Melrose or, you know, I mean, it's just a different thing. So I love California because, I mean, first of all, the landscape is incredible.
Yep.
From the ocean to the mountains to everything. And then you have, I feel like everybody gets there and they sort of choose to be themselves. They're like, yeah, I'm gay, or yeah, I'm a freak, or yeah, this is how I dress. Yeah, I mean, people just kind of, whatever they are, they seem to come out in California.
Yeah.
And so you're in the midst of that, and it's a cool thing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Baltimore, you know, one of the most notable Baltimore people that come to my mind when I think of Baltimore, like John Waters. Who are some notable writers and creative artists that live in Baltimore that you have experience with? And is there any sort of close community there with artists?
You know, Baltimore, I mean, it's such a strange place. I mean, because I'm still an outsider, it seems bizarre to me. There are so many great writers and filmmakers and here, and there's such a huge community. I went to a reading last night, and there's all these different writers there. But, I mean, Baltimore, I mean, Larry Doyle lives here, and James Primus, who writes kids' books and YA and movies, lives here, and Laura Lippman lives here, and, I mean, you can just go on and on and on and on. And there's all these interesting writers, and everybody in Baltimore, and maybe because Baltimore is a somewhat humbling city, like, you're never cool the way you are in the East Village or something, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, no matter what, there is no cool in Baltimore. We're all in Baltimore. And so, and the writers here really come together and help each other out and support each other and have parties. I mean, Marion Winnick, the essayist, is here, and she's great. And, you know, and we all kind of come together, and there's a lot of cafe writing room. People meet at a cafe, and we sit around and write, and there's writer parties, and there's a lot of interesting supportive stuff. I'm in a writer's group. I'm actually meeting them tonight with Jeff Becker, who's, you know, an incredible writer, has a bunch of books out and a bunch of stuff in Best American Short Stories, and Ron Tanner has 4 books out, and it's been doing like a 99 city tour, and Michael Downs,
uh-huh,
who has a, we're adding some states. Yeah.
Right, exactly. We're creating states just for the experience.
He's making his own states for this
exactly.
tour. So it's going to be
exactly.
a 99-state tour. But, and, you know, so I'm with all these great writers, and it's very stimulating, and, you know, and I was just reading the stories last night for my writer's group tonight, you know, and I was getting really jealous, and that kind of jealousy, I think, is good for you. It's like, you know, you're like, fuck him, man, I got to go write something. So there's, I think we inspire each other and we help each other, and it's a great, and it's a small enough city that we pretty much know each other.
Right.
You know, I mean, John Waters doesn't live far from where I am. He's, you know, down the road. So it's a weird little city where nobody's cool, and I think that's kind of a good thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
in
we were talking earlier about those things that help to ground you in your life. I guess living in Baltimore might be one of those things.
Yeah, definitely living in Baltimore is right. There is, like, you just can't you can't be cool there. I mean, I go to New York a lot, and I'll be walking down the street, like, I mean, particularly in the East Village or something, and like everybody is great looking, and they're all wearing the exact right thing, no matter what the weather, you know, or the right coat, or. And I just am like this freckled dork in the wrong boots. And it's just like, you know, and that's okay. It's like, wow, look at these cool people. But in Baltimore, there's no such thing as the person wearing the right thing or the dork wearing the wrong thing.
Right.
It's like, we're all dorks here.
We're all dorks here, right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, John Waters is as our king here.
Exactly.
I mean, like, you can't get dorkier than that.
Yeah.
Like, you can't. It couldn't be dorkier.
Yeah. So you mentioned your family before, and, you know, one of the themes that comes up in the Wonder Bread Summer is the idea that the family you count on isn't necessarily the one you were born with. I was hoping you could talk a little about your own family upbringing and how some of those situations later became inspiration for your novels.
Yeah. I mean, my parents are from the East Coast. And actually, we 3 kids were born back east. I was born in Boston and then taken out to California when we were young. And so when we got to California, I mean, like I said, California is a place where everybody kind of comes out. My mother, who grew up on a 5,000-acre ranch in Vermont with her very uptight parents, who had no interest in my father for many reasons, but including the reason that he was Jewish, you know, came to California and just like took off her bra and grew out her armpit hair and planted a marijuana orchard in the backyard. You know, and my dad was throwing pots on a kick wheel, and I mean, he's an English professor and he was writing books and he was, you know, following a career trajectory, but they kind of, you know, sort of came out there. So I grew up in this somewhat chaos of just, you know, being in a family where these two people are doing this stuff and exploring each other, which was, I mean, it was pretty common back then. We were the ignored generation. It wasn't, there was no such thing as a helicopter parent. Or if there was one, it was, you know, sort of odd.
Right.
So there's that. And, yeah, and so the parents, like in the summer of Naked Swim Parties, that book was just inspired by a memory of watching my parents and all their friends swim naked and being a kid and sitting on the edge of the pool with my bathing suit on, because the kids would always wear suits, and watching one of my parents' friends, a guy, jump on the diving board and watching his penis and his balls fly up and down as he jumped on the board.
Right.
And being like 8. I mean, in the book, she's, you know, 14, but at the time I think I was maybe 8 or 9, and just being sort of horrified by this vision, like, whoa, and thinking, I'm never going to have sex in my life. I'm never going to touch one of those. I mean, it was just so bizarre. And so that whole book came out of that sort of memory. And then Drinking Closer to Home was kind of exploring the whole family dynamic and where things went and, you know, addictions and affairs and lunacy and a coming out and going through a slut phase and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And so that was that. And then in the Wonder Bread summer, the Allie's mother abandons her to be the tambourine girl in the band. And my mother didn't do that, but my best friend, one of my best friends growing up, her mother, when she was 5, and abandoned them to be the tambourine girl in the band.
Wow.
And that always stuck with me. Like, that was always stuck in my head. Like, here's this friend for years and years, and we're really close, and I'd seen her mother maybe twice when her mother dropped in to visit. But, you know, it's like my parents were off doing their stuff and smoking pot and going to parties and whatever, but her mom just left to play the tambourine. And so that always just stuck in my head. I mean, first of all, because the tambourine is such an unskilled instrument, or maybe it takes more skill than I realize, but there's something about, like, devoting your life to something that you smack against your ass.
Right.
It just seems, it's not like she's going to play flamenco guitar or something. It was like, she's playing the tambourine. And then to leave to do that, like, there was just something so, like, that just hung in my head. And when I thought of this, you know, and now when I look back at this friend and I think of her, I always think her mother left to be the tambourine girl in the band. So I threw that, you know, I put that in the book. I thought, okay, Allie's mother is going to be gone and she's left to be the tambourine girl in the band. So the parents in the Wonder Bread summer are, of the three books, the farthest from my, or I should say furthest from my actual parents. And in the other two books, it's much more like the family I grew up with.
Right. Well, you know, sex and sort of sexually related themes are throughout your work. I'm curious, how easy is it for you to write sex themes or to write sexually?
Because
when I read it, it seems very natural.
Yeah, I don't have a problem. No, I mean, maybe it's about growing up in California. I think of it as part of life.
Yeah.
You know, when you start having sex and, you know, sex is great and men are great and people are great. I mean, you know, it's like it's a great thing, but I don't think of it as, is it something to be terrified of or avoid? I mean, I think in writing sex scenes, I never feel like I'm writing erotica or pornography. And I think that maybe the key to doing that is that in every scene, you know, because in every scene I'm writing, essentially what you're doing is you're revealing character and you're revealing who these people are. And you're revealing who they are by what they do. So if you're writing a sex scene and you're revealing character, then the scene, you know, at least I hope, and the ones I read, is compelling. It's compelling to read about the internal workings of somebody's mind or the internal workings of you know, or their impulses or how they connect to other people. And it's interesting to read how they connect to other people sexually and how the sex goes down with them. I mean, I think if you're doing a play-by-play, you know, he put his penis there and she put her legs here and he said, oh, and she said, wow, or whatever, then you're writing pornography. But if, I mean, sex scenes, I don't think about them consciously. If I'm writing, I never even realized there's a lot of sex in my book until somebody else points it out. So when I'm writing, I don't even realize I'm writing sex. I'm just, things are happening and I have sex. I like having sex and the people in my books have sex.
Yeah.
So it's like eating, you know, they eat too. And
yeah.
It's like when, it's the same with food. If you write about how somebody eats, you're revealing character. If somebody eating with their mouth open and breathing through their nose and, you know, making hee-haw noises or whatever, you're revealing character. If you write, you know, about what they eat, you're writing food porn, which I know a lot of people like. So because I don't write erotica or porn, I don't really think of any of those scenes as any different than anything else I write. It's always where this character is at the moment and how they're connecting to this person and how the sex is going down, and not, oh, where does his dick go and, you know,
yeah,
how does she spit on it? You know, I mean, it just doesn't, I'm not thinking that way.
Right.
I mean, in this book, she does have sex with Billy Idol.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to bring that up,
and
Billy Idol. How did you get the inspiration for that? And yeah, how did that come about?
I mean, it was like, you know, I mean, I put the book in 1983, and Billy Idol was pretty big in 1983, and he was, like, really great-looking and attractive and sexy. I mean, he's, like, I think he's still sexy if you Google him and look at pictures of him. You know, but he was, like, so sexy. And so there was a little bit of wish fulfillment. I was like, you know, her mom's with the band. She's going to meet some rock stars. You know, and at some point I was just like, yeah, I would love to have sex with Billy Idol, but I can't. But I had my character have sex with him.
There you go.
So even that, in writing that, it wasn't like, oh, what would it be like to have sex with Billy Idol? I mean, even when I was writing that, it was more like, what would she be thinking when she's having sex? Like, what's running through your mind when you're having sex with Billy Idol? So it was more along the lines of filtering it through the internal workings of her mind as she's having sex with Billy Idol.
Yeah. You know, something else that runs throughout a lot of your work is humor. How did you get to be so darn funny? I mean, are you as funny and charming in real life as you are in your writing? Or how does humor work for you?
I mean, I sort of like sex. I mean, I don't realize I'm funny until somebody else reads the book, and then they're like, that was so funny. And then I never know what people will laugh at until I'm reading it out loud, you know, usually on book tour, and then people laugh, and I was like, oh, that's funny. So I think what it comes down to is that I find life pretty hilarious. I mean, I look at things, I mean, even the worst things that have happened to me, I look back on them, and they seem pretty hilarious. I mean, life is just ridiculous, and everything seems funny to me. So I think it's not that I'm a particularly funny person. I think it's more the point of view in which I look at things reveals just how funny life is.
Right, right. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you didn't study fiction until graduate school. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, I was always keeping diaries, and I wrote compulsively in them, but I never thought of myself as a writer. And I was also always I was always reading. I mean, I always read and read and read.
Right.
My boyfriend in college, who I later, you know, had a baby with and married, he was an English major, and I would read all his books that he had to read for his classes, and I would read them all too.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I wrote, but it didn't occur to me that I was a writer until much later.
Yeah, you've made, since those days and now, I mean, you've made incredible headway. I mean, you've had this incredible journey. How would you account for all that phenomenal growth in your writing and writing career since then until now?
I think because I'm, because I was always writing whether or not it got published or whether or not I expected to get published, and I would just try and write every day. So I think I sort of did the Malcolm Gladwell, just do it over and over and over again, because I was, when I started doing it, I was going to do it whether I got published or not. And once you give up on this idea of doing it for an end result, then you're really practicing it and practicing it and practicing it. And so I think because I was just committed to practicing it, I hope it's good. I have no idea about it. It's like I didn't, you know, take a stab at it. Because, I mean, writing is, you know, I mean, as you know, I mean, it's all failure. You write, you send stuff out, it gets rejected. And then you can either choose to keep writing
mm-hmm.
or you choose to stop. And so in spite of all the failures and rejections, which are continuous for everybody all the time. I mean, every writer, even, you know, huge writers who sell millions of copies, I mean, there's still certain amounts of failures and different, you know, it's like you write and you have a shitty writing day, or you write something that's shitty, and you just have to choose to keep writing.
Right.
So I definitely definitely kind of worked through it. Yeah. And, you know, and it might have something to do with being the ignored middle child. I'm used to not being seen or heard, so it's like it was kind of okay just to keep going in a sort of, you know, oblivious darkness.
Yeah. So we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you one more question. You know, you have three well-received novels in your bed, all of them in one form, with your family, and your son, or family, and your family, and looking back at the novels, what would you say some lessons, what are some of the lessons you've learned about life and love and family?
Wow, that's a big question. I think part of the writing and writing about my family, you know, fictionalizing them, part of it was accepting them. And so I think that if there's any place where I ended up at, you know, it was in total acceptance and like, okay, these are who these people are, and everyone did the best they could. And we all love each other deeply. And maybe people failed each other here and there or did this and that or did other hurtful things. But in the end, we all did the best we could at the time. And we love each other. And so I think that in the end there's a certain just grand acceptance. Like, all right, well, that's who you are, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, still love you. You know, I mean, right now we're all grown-ups, and so you can't – there's no one to blame or be angry. I mean, it's ridiculous to be angry at anybody or hold blame or be bitter. It's like we're going to die in the end, and we're just hurtling towards death. So between now and death, I just want to love them deeply, write as much as I can, create as much as I can, just pray that it's good stuff, you know, take care of my kids. And
yeah.
Give what you can.
Yeah. So, Jessica, what's the best way for people to find out about you online, either about you, you know, if you're going to be doing any readings or promotions or your novels?
Definitely my website, jessicaanyablau.com. So there's two A's together, JessicaAnyablau.com. And right now, I mean, I've finished book tour for Wonder Bread Summer. Right now I'm just working on two new books. And I don't think I'm out there that much, although I will be at UWP if anybody's going to be in Seattle in a couple of weeks. And, yeah, definitely my website.
Nice. With me today has been the writer, incredibly talented, entertaining, enticing. I could just continue heaping on the adjectives, Jessica Anya Blau. Jessica, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Rich. You're great, and I adore you, and I love your work, as you know.
Well,
thank you.
I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify, and Twitter. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be jeweler Jennifer Jesse Smith. We'll be talking about her fine work and the creative process that gets her there. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.